This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll check in with CASA of San Luis Obispo.
It is a pretty unique volunteer role when they're specifically assigned to a child and really becomes a part of that child's life.
Also, you'll get an update on downtown San Luis Obispo's farmers market.
There are now rules and regulations in place where you have to wait in line, you have to space yourself out. Like these things that never we just took for granted all the time, now we have to really consider with these events.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 22nd. I'm Francisco Martinez. First, KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer reports from U.S. Army Reserve Base Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County. He visits with the crew of Mercy Air Medevac Operations. Mercy Air's primary mission is to support military operations on base, but they also respond to civilian casualties in Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties.
My name is Jared Zarletta. I'm the area manager for Air Methods. We operate the Mercy Air Base, Mercy Air 20 at Fort Hunter Liggett in California. It is a military contract where we support the fort here and the regular operations. We're here as a 24/7, 365 response in the event that there was, you know, any sort of training accident or injury on base, or even for the few permanent personnel that live at the base. If there's a medical emergency with a family member, we're here to get them safely to a higher level of care, just because this is a very remote location and there's not a lot of medical services that can get you anywhere you need to go very quickly.
On base 24/7, how many helos are typically stationed here and how many are airworthy, ready to take off on a moment's notice?
So the contract requires that we're operational 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So aircraft obviously need maintenance once in a while. There's no way to work on them and expect to stay in service. So we do have a backup aircraft here. The primary aircraft is a 412, a Bell 412, and that gives us the ability to take multiple patients if there is a mass casualty event where there's critical patients that need to get to, again, a higher level of care. But it also gives us the ability to take a lot of weight or passengers in that situation. Very few helicopters have that capability at a reasonable operating cost. So the Bell 412 allows us to do that. For the backup, we have a BK-117, which is slightly less capable airframe, but when there's maintenance going on one of them, we're in the other one.
On this base, it's sleepy sometimes, but I've been on base when there have been 10,000 troops training with strikers and whatnot. So you could have something horrible go down and have to respond big time to, like you said, a mass casualty.
Absolutely, yeah. I was recently retired out of the Marine Corps, and I was up here in 2014, and I remember we brought something along the lines of 2,000, 2,500 Marines here within a matter of a couple of days. So it's very common here for the ranges to get used like that by units that are getting ready to deploy as pre-deployment exercises. So it can go from zero to several thousand in a matter of days or even hours.
And the crew aboard each aircraft, you have a pilot and a flight officer?
We have one pilot, and then we have a nurse and a medic.
My name's Leslie Brown. I'm a flight paramedic here at Fort Hunter Liggett. Our crew consists of a pilot, a flight nurse, and a flight medic. So we have additional critical care training for the paramedic and the nurse. They also provide us with extensive FAA-required aviation training so that we do know a little bit about what's going on in the cockpit and can assist should there be an emergency with the aircraft.
Possible you could land it.
No. I wouldn't go that far. But we are able to read their charts in an emergency to help with crew resource management and make it safer for everybody on board the aircraft.
So when you're airborne, are you backseat?
On the way to the scene,
yeah.
One medical crew member is up front with the pilot.
Okay.
And then when we're transporting, both the medical crew members are caring for the patient.
How many litters can be in the back?
We have two there on either side, so we can take two patients laying supine or laying on their backs. Mm-hmm. In addition, we have two other seats that we can transport patients. So depending on the weight capacity, which is up to the pilot that day and our fuel load and such, we could carry four patients depending on how critical they are in nature. Mm-hmm. Generally, we We don't like to take more than two critical patients because there are only two of us in the bed.
Yeah, I was going to say you'd be super busy.
Yeah, but we did just have a multi-casualty incident here last summer with the fires where we transported three total between this aircraft and the aircraft in Paso. So it is nice having a sister base really close.
Yeah, no kidding. And to fly to Paso, how long?
The flight to Paso is about 10 minutes. It's a beautiful flight. Yeah. Definitely different than the drive.
And over here?
My name is Jason Martin. I'm the pilot here at 400 Liggett right now. I'm actually a relief pilot. I kind of travel around and cover a lot of different bases on and off here for about 3.5 years now.
Is your background military training?
I am military, but I was a grunt in the military, so I'm civilian trained as far as helicopters goes. After a time of riding in the back of those things, you kind of want to get up front eventually. So,
what other bases do you guys have? It's Mercy Air.
So Mercy Air is one of our California and Nevada bases. The program name is Mercy Air. Air Methods owns all of our programs. We have over 300 bases in 48 states.
Wow.
Flying over 400 aircraft. So pretty much anywhere you go, you will find an Air Methods program. Here in California, we have a number of bases in Southern California, as well as Merced, Mariposa, and then the SkyLife program in Fresno is also an Air Methods program. So,
interesting.
One thing that I really like about our company is that they give us all the training and tools we need to take care of the patient at the moment and the immediate need, but our company goes beyond that and takes care of the patient even when they're recovering by making sure they don't get any surprise bills and letting them focus on just recovering rather than dealing with medical bills.
We're about 26 miles from US 101. Let's say I was in a head-on and you guys were called to extract and I don't have insurance. What happens?
We're still gonna come.
I think it's important to note what's really important when we get these calls, we get zero information. We don't know what's wrong with the patient. We know how many there is, and we know how far away you are, and that's right. So we're already in the air well before we even know what's wrong with you, let alone whether or not you have insurance or what you're...
Not an issue. Not an operative at all.
No, it's for us as a flight crew, you're going to get to where you're going no matter what.
Talk about range of operation. Let's say that I'm severely burnt, and you know that you got to get me to Stanford or to Fresno. Can you make it to both from here?
We sure can.
Okay.
We have a very extensive range. We are well versed on the different capabilities of the receiving hospitals, both locally and pretty much statewide. That way, in case, for instance, Stanford is weathered in, we can't get in there because the cloud layer is too low, we can take you to Fresno. We always have alternate options and alternate ways of getting you to the definitive care that you need. And we're more than willing to go by ground if for some reason the weather changes while we're waiting to extricate you from the car. We can take all our gear, get in the ambulance, and provide that critical care
on the ground.
Yep, on the ground, all the way to the hospital.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Contributor Tom Wilmer visits with the crew of Mercy Air Medevac Operations, Jared Zaroletta, Leslie Brown, and pilot Jason Martin.
Back to primary mission. Again, the reason that you're here on an Army base, Army Reserve, is that's your primary reason. Take care of issues that happen on base, right?
That's correct.
So talk to us about, back in time, things that have happened, the things that have gone wrong that you had to respond.
Well, pre-COVID, this base during the summer especially gets very, very busy. And then the heat out here gets to be 100 plus on a regular basis.
At 8 a.m.
Yes, at 8 a.m. And we have a lot of reservists coming out to do their summer training who aren't used to this heat and aren't acclimated. So there have been times where we've had three back-to-back-to-back transports, heat-related illnesses mixed in with other trauma issues. We see a lot of vehicle rollovers and such just because people aren't used to driving those vehicles on a daily basis and then come out here and are asked to do it under stressful circumstances.
Talk to us for a moment about flying in adverse conditions. What are your limits?
Oh, it's not my favorite thing to do, but we have company minimums. They're basically set by the FAA over years and years of how to keep the helicopter EMS industry just safer in general. But more than that, every pilot has their own personal minimums. When it really comes down to it, when we're in this mountainous terrain that we're in over here, company minimums are usually lower than what my personal minimums or my crew's personal minimums are.
More conservative?
More conservative, much more. And the reality is you can check weather as much as you want, you know, in Paso or in Salinas, but we're in a really remote area here where there's no weather checking around where we are.
Right.
It's you got to go outside and see if you can see the mountains or not.
Put your finger up.
Yeah, so it's something we do every day. You know, I brief the crew as soon as they come in on shift. We kind of make a plan. This is what we can expect throughout the day. And when the call comes, it should be a quick minute to minute and a half of us talking about what the weather's looking like, if it's changed or not. But the big thing is all three of us, you know, have to agree that it's a go. We're going to go take the call. And that's before we even leave the door.
So visual is huge.
Visual is really big out here. It sounds weird, but if we can see certain peaks of certain mountains around us, we know what the minimums are. And if we can get out of our little area that we're in to where there is weather reporting stations. So visual is very big where we are right now. Again, it's just being familiar with the area that we're used to flying in.
And the other variable that I know you would deal with would be wind and turbulence and updrafts of the mountains and whatnot. How do you counter and deal with that and anticipate?
We're lucky to be flying an aircraft that is it's heavy. It takes a lot of wind to move that thing around. We're sitting at almost 12,000 pounds a lot of times. Luckily, turbulence, it's got to be pretty windy for us to have that sort of thing. You know, when winds start getting up to 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, it's going to be an uncomfortable ride, or we're not going to take the call. You know, at some point, we have to just step back and look at it from a safety perspective. Luckily, where we are here, that very rarely happens. I mean, we're looking at kind of thunderstorm-type conditions for the wind to get that bad. 30 knots is no problem in the aircraft we fly, though, and I'd say that's about what the most we get on a normal day.
So 20, 30, pretty stable.
Yeah, it's a very stable aircraft. It can really take a lot of wind, and you won't even really feel it. It's just got a lot of weight to it, so. Yeah.
Right now, well, you have four staff people here in the office. How many typically are on duty at one time?
So we fly with a three-man crew, three-person crew, I should say. We have a pilot, a flight nurse, and a flight paramedic. If for some reason we are short a flight paramedic, we can also fly with two nurses. And that's our regular staffing. So generally, there's just three of us here. Our pilots change halfway through the day. They fly 12-hour shifts, but our med crew flies a 24-hour shift.
So let's talk a moment about your Paso Robles operation. That's fairly new. It's an addition.
It opened last August.
What is there?
Paso Robles base is slightly different. We have a very unique mission profile here where we support both the military operation and the community. The Paso Robles base is a community-based service. So they service the entire San Luis Obispo County as well as Southern Monterey County. They border both Kern County, Kings County, and Fresno County on the east side of San Luis.
Santa Barbara?
They can service Santa Barbara as well. Mm-hmm. There has never been a medevac aircraft dedicated to San Luis, stationed in San Luis, until the Paso Robles base opened in August.
So it's a game changer.
It is a game changer for the residents. I grew up in San Luis County and worked the ground ambulance and fire engine for years. I saw the need there for a lot of years, and it wasn't until I came to work for Air Methods that I realized that we could really do some good and change could be made. So
that's really
having
cool.
That base in Paso is exciting. It's staffed again with a pilot, a flight nurse, and flight medic.
And you have two helos there?
They have one.
One.
An EC-135, so it is also IFR capable, which means it can do instrument-rated approaches and such.
Oh, nice.
It is staffed with all the same equipment, same training, so we're basically a little flying ICU or ER. They are as well.
That's really cool. And your backup, let's say something mechanical happened to that aircraft, would you maybe bring one from here?
Right. That's the beauty of working for a company that is the largest medevac operator in the world. We have aircraft that can come from all over the state at a moment's notice to support an operation that may need help. So we have our aircraft here that can be used as a spare elsewhere, as well as the aircraft in Fresno. Southern California, really, when you're flying, isn't that far away. So they have backup aircraft down there as well that can come up.
Right now, we're in Southern Monterey County. Going north, where is the next Mercy Air base?
The next Mercy Air base to the north would be inland in Merced and Mariposa.
So they'd be going into the Sierras then, huh?
Yep, they do. They fly into Yosemite. I have yet to be able to fly in, but I hear it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, nice ride.
But we get the Big Sur coastline, so
right.
I can't really be too sad about it.
And just a moment back, you touched on the fires, the Big Sur fire. And people don't realize, I was on base when that was happening, and it was right over your shoulder. I mean, it was eerie.
It was right over our shoulder. I have some pictures of the fire encroaching onto the base. It actually came onto Fort Hunter Liggett property, and the fire department here did an amazing job of making sure it didn't get too close for comfort.
Mm-hmm.
But that did involve, we had some firefighters that got burned over. It was really awesome to be a part of taking care of them in their time of need. That's something that I find just very fortunate about this job, is getting to be impactful to somebody on their worst day, really, because every time we get launched, it's somebody's worst day.
A couple of things we didn't talk about too much. We focused a lot on our medical mission here, but a big part of what we do, probably, I mean, I'd say 60% of our flying out here is actually supporting the troops that come here to train. For instance, this is a really popular base for the non-commissioned officers, the military police guys that come out here and do their training. So, and we've linked up with the officers that do that, kind of put that training on, and in their third week out here, they'll do a mock mission where they have to extract an injured soldier. It's good training for them, and they'll send up what's called a 9-line, which is 9 lines of information that is what's required to launch a medevac helo. So they'll send that information up to the range control, and they'll give it over to us. It gives us a chance to practice our response time, and we'll come over there and we'll pick that guy up for him. And that's just one of the things we do. We do that monthly now. The Navy SEALs come out here and they'll use us for various things. It kind of keeps us on our toes. A lot of times we can go a month without an actual patient flight out here. So for us to stay up on our response time and everything, it's nice to have the troops using us for that sort of thing out here.
I know historically, the British Special Forces, probably not supposed to talk about this, but they jump in here in the middle of the winter?
Yep, they were just out here for almost 4 weeks.
So are you locked and loaded, ready to go for that?
Yeah, we work really closely with them. They brief us every day on what their jump times are, what their plans are, what altitudes, and we don't stage where they're landing, but we are ready. And,
right. And
there's certain times, you know, when there's not a lot of people on base or anything like that, you know, there's a little bit more freedom. Maybe somebody goes for a run or something like that in the middle of the day. But when there's troops on base or something like that going on, when they're jumping, I mean, we're here, we're ready to go and off the ground in under 10 minutes.
I know maybe 3-4 years ago, I was with the 7th Infantry Division. They were training. And remember that? There were like 9,000 troops. Yes. And a lot of it was remote with the strikers and whatnot. Would you move your base of temporary operation to have the helo closer to the action, or you still stay here?
We still stay here. We can respond to anywhere on base. The flight time anywhere on base is under
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Right. Yeah. So, and range control will brief us what operations are happening, especially when there are a lot of troops on base. We will go over every morning and get a brief on what to expect for the day. So we know what areas of the base are active, are ready. Like Jason said, get off the ground under 10 minutes. We're on scene. And my name is Leslie Brown, flight paramedic.
I'm Jared Zaraleta, area manager.
I'm Jason Martin.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Mercier on base at Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County.
On today's nonprofit story, we'll check in with San Luis Obispo County's court-appointed Special Advocates for Children program, known as CASA.
This is the nonprofit story. I am Dr. Consuelo Mutes. Today I have Katie Robinson, Program Director at CASA. CASA of San Luis Obispo County advocates for the best interest of abused and neglected children within the court system. Katie, welcome to the nonprofit story.
Thank you for having me.
So CASA, I know that a lot of us have heard about CASA. It's court-appointed special advocates for the children within our county. But give us some history and background on the mission and work of CASA.
So our mission is really to provide a volunteer directly to a child that is going through the dependency court process. So they are in foster care. They've been removed from their parent because of abuse or neglect. And they start having changes in their placements and their schools. And really the goal is to match a child with a volunteer in the community to really ensure for their safety, to make sure they feel supported. They have a consistent adult that is following them through the journey of foster care and through the court system. Mm-hmm. And so our goal is to recruit, train, and support volunteers that can be that person for a child.
How long have you been in the county?
San Luis Obispo County CASA, we have been 27 years. In the state of California, most counties have a CASA program that works mm-hmm. directly with the children in foster care within that county. And national CASA is throughout the United States. And that mission has been going forward for about 40 years now. Most every state in the United States have some form of a CASA program there to support foster youth.
So do you serve San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County? I was just noticing some of those numbers on your website.
Yeah, so we are just strictly San Luis Obispo County jurisdiction, and Santa Barbara County has a robust CASA program as well. And Ventura County, all of our surrounding counties have a CASA program for the kids that are living locally.
Wonderful. So tell us a bit about the need here in San Luis Obispo County. As you mentioned, children waiting for a volunteer and their help. What is the need? How many children are you looking at?
So we have children throughout San Luis Obispo County that we do not have an assigned advocate for. So we do have children with our volunteers that we do advocate for. And that's about 180, 190 children. And then we have over 100 children on the wait list. So those are the children that we consider are in need of a CASA. And our mission is always to be recruiting volunteers and adults that would be willing to take on this volunteer role.
And these children, where do they come from and how do they get into your program?
So the children come from our community that are in some really difficult family situations. And unfortunately, their family has come to the attention of child welfare services. Mm-hmm. And through that process, there is a sustained abuse petition on the parent, and the child is usually removed from their parent and placed in some type of substitute care provider situation. Mm-hmm. So usually that's a foster home. Obviously, the goal is always to keep children with relatives if there's someone able to care for them, with the goal through the court proceedings is to reunify with the parents when at all possible.
Well, so it's the child welfare system that is the connection with CASA.
Correct.
And then you get the volunteer to work with them. And in looking at your statistics online, it seems that the most abused children are between the ages of 6 and 15 years old. Is there a particular reason for that?
6 to 15 years old, I mean, I think that age range rings a bell because there are eyes and ears on this population. They're in the school systems, they're out in the community, which usually means there's people or adults that have eyes and ears on these children. And, you know, obviously as a mandated reporter or a community member, if you're concerned about the welfare of a child, reporting that is a way that comes to the attention of child welfare services. We also have the younger population. We do have infants and toddlers, the 0 to 5 year old population. During COVID, that's been a population that has risen because they're in hospital settings or there's medical, you know, professionals that are working with these children. Obviously, with schools being virtual and remote, those children that have come to the attention of child welfare have decreased.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting point right there, and that the understanding of what might be going on in the home may have decreased. Do you feel like children might be in more danger because of the ones that would be in situations that would be difficult? Are you finding they may be in more danger because there is not a way to recognize the issue?
Correct. That's definitely a concern. That's been a dialogue and a conversation that we've been having with child welfare, with the courts, with mandated reporters, these people that usually do see children. I think we can all agree that, you know, COVID has increased stress in families. And I think some of the families that we come in contact were already a bit marginal, or they were really unsteady. And so a pandemic that comes along with all of those unintended consequences for some of our families that struggle with substance use and mental health and domestic violence in their relationships. I think we all have that idea that we're still very concerned about those children.
So do you get reports from the community that might ask you to come out and take a look, or would they call child welfare? And
that would always be child welfare. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we get, CASA gets the children or access and information about the children from the Superior Court. So every child that is detained, we have a CASA court order on that. We have access to all of their records and can, you know, begin looking for an advocate, supporting that, seeing what the needs of the child are. So kind of once that has already taken place, then that's when the children come in to contact with CASA.
So tell us about the volunteer program, as it seems to be your most important situation right now, to have people who can volunteer. Who are these people that volunteer and do this great work for you? Where do they come from? How are they trained?
We always want to know where they come from. We would love to tap into that source of where we get volunteers from. Mm-hmm. Volunteers are obviously adults in the community that feel the need or a calling to support a child. I think across the board, you know, word of mouth about CASA is the common way that people have heard about us. We do have populations of retired professions that still have an interest in working with children and want to kind of come into a different role. So there is definitely always an effort, you know, for our agency to be looking for volunteers, finding people, having conversations with people of what this looks like for them. Because it is a pretty unique volunteer role when they're specifically assigned to a child and really becomes a part of that child's life. So we have a training program. It's all virtual. So that was a change that we made when last year in March. We were very surprised and humbled by the response that we did get for volunteers. We had 5 training classes last year. And there was a great response from the community that are willing, even during a pandemic, to go through this and get out into the community and be assigned to a child that's been abused and neglected.
Well, if you are just joining us, this is Dr. Consuelo Mewkes, host of The Nonprofit Story, speaking with Katie Robinson, Program Director at CASA. So Katie, let's continue with the volunteers and talk a bit about the training program. If someone is interested in volunteering with you, what would be their expectations? What are the qualifications to become a volunteer?
So we have a 36-hour training. Like I said before, it's all virtual, so it's all online. We'll continue that way for at least the remainder of this year. And so it's about a 2 to 3 week, twice a week in the evening, training class, learning about different topics that impact the children that we work with. So we're looking at kind of child development, family systems, substance abuse, mental health needs. And so really kind of all encompassing, you know, what are some of the issues that we see in working with families that have come in contact with child welfare. In addition to that, they become a mandated reporter. They attend court. So they do an observation of the dependency court calendar. And then they get sworn in by our juvenile judge as an officer of the court. Mm-hmm. And so through that process, then they get matched with a child and a supervisor that will support them through that. And so we're looking at about 10 to 15 hours per month. The timeline average, obviously depending on the child and what their needs are. We do ask that you see your child weekly. So it's a weekly contact. Obviously with vaccines and community opening back up, you know, in-person contact is preferred. And so really for somebody being willing to be involved with the child, really show up, our volunteers really have to put their ego aside in this line of work. And that can sometimes be a really hard balance because they're connected, they care, they can really grow an attachment to this child. And unfortunately, sometimes, you know, systems of care and bureaucracies don't always line up with that type of work.
Yeah, it sounds like something where you really have to have the heart for this, as well as the dedication. What specifically then would we do? I know you're saying that we actually take the child to court, the volunteer. Do they take the child to court? Do they meet them there? And when they do the home visits, what kind of responsibilities does the volunteer have for that?
The weekly outing is really taking the child, based off of their age, of course, when appropriate, out into the community. So doing activities, you know, exploring different areas of the county, you know, going to the library. So obviously during COVID, we had a lot of limitations on what was able to happen, but I feel that our volunteers were very creative in their contact with the children. And then in addition to really just meeting with the child, spending time with them, getting to know them, that's a big part of the role. And kind of the other side of the role is really working with the team of professionals that this child might have, working with foster parents, working with teachers, working with social workers, working with the minors attorney. So kind of all of our youth have a kind of a team. Some are larger than others, depending on their needs. But the idea is to really be able to coordinate, build rapport, collaborate with them, and really identify, are there needs that this child has? Are they doing well in school, or do they need additional supports, or is there mental health issues that we might need more attention on? So really making sure the overall well-being of the child is being met by these other professionals that are in their life.
And the volunteer, do they select that age child, or do you help the people to determine what age they would have?
That has really changed over time. We've been fortunate to be able to grow our program over the last 3 or 4 years, which has really dwindled our waitlist children, the number of children that do need CASAs. Obviously, that's positive, but kind of on the other end of that, kind of the pool of children that we have on the waitlist has really shifted. And so we definitely say that 5 to 12, 13 year age is kind of that age that everybody kind of wants to get involved with, because why wouldn't you like a child that age, and I can take them out and we can do things and we can explore. Right. And so that age for us, for our waitlisted, have really dwindled. And the populations that we really see that we need advocates for right now are infants and toddlers, which are 0 to 5, and our teens, the 15 to, 18, 19 year olds. And so that is kind of, so that has changed, to answer your question. So we really need people that are willing to kind of give me what you got, whatever your greatest need is. We like, we like those responses when we ask them, what type of child would you like? Whatever the need is. Because then we can really do a good match for what the child's needs are.
We were talking a little bit before, and you were mentioning about how the pandemic has changed some of the programs that happen with CASA. Give us a little bit of information on some of those struggles that you are encountering.
I think for all of us in the community, COVID has really impacted everybody very differently. Unfortunately, the children under the jurisdiction of the court or in foster care can have some greater needs than maybe a regular population of children. So really mental health, substance use, occupational therapy, physical therapy, kind of all of these services, school, all really came to a halt. And then it was really, let's get everybody, engaged online. So we've seen different areas of success for that for children. And some of our youth, they've done great going to school virtually, because really their issues at school were maybe peers and social. And so when they're just at home doing the academics, that they have really thrived. And then we have other children where really that connection, either that home environment's not supportive, the availability of a parent to be doing their virtual school with them. And so we definitely have seen children, I don't think we would say the need for those services and those interventions have decreased, but really the access to them. And to get children, to do therapy or counseling online, it's a struggle, to get them to connect with teachers and peers and supportive people even if they are available, it really takes a lot of work to do and a lot of emphasis. So to do that kind of from a distance because of the restrictions that we had during COVID, it definitely created different scenarios that we haven't had to address before. But like I said, we did 5 training classes last year and we had about over 80 volunteers come through, like want to sign up to do this work during the pandemic. And some of them have just hit the ground running to really get the supports in. And then obviously as our community is opening back up, hopefully in a positive direction, kind of getting really back out into the community and doing those activities and interactions and the in-person visits are really going to improve the advocacy for the youth.
Wow, this is just a strong program and so well needed in this community. I'm so glad you're letting people know the details. I wonder if next month, which is Volunteer Awareness Month, is CASA going to be doing anything special?
We are. We try to find ways throughout the year to really thank our youth, our volunteers for showing up. I mean, we have volunteers that have been with kids over 10 years. They're on one case and it's been open for 10 years and they just stay committed and they stay steadfast. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing some marketing. We've got some banners. We usually do a Celebrate CASA event, and that's kind of our, when we can do things in person, we kind of try to find those opportunities to celebrate our volunteers, but we've had to shift and trying to find other creative ways to let our volunteers know that they're appreciated, you know, by the community as a whole, including our organization.
As a 501c3 nonprofit, are you ever looking for donations from the community also to support your work?
Yes, that's always a need that we have. We definitely have, you know, a whole team of staff that really work on the fundraising piece. I'm fortunate to stay on the program side of things, which I enjoy. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely, you know, the events, the marketing, and then really through COVID, a lot of our funding and grants and matching funds that come to us are from matching our volunteer hours. So we keep track of how many hours our volunteers spend. And obviously through the pandemic, we've seen a sharp decline in those number of hours because they weren't out in the community. They were doing phone calls or Zoom visits, and that has really kind of impacted it. So we're always looking for donations. You know, there's sponsorships, there's business. There's a lot of opportunities if people are willing to explore those to help us financially as well.
So Katie, if someone is interested in either becoming a volunteer or helping you financially, how can they find out more information about CASA?
So our website, slowcasa.org, is going to have all of the information to become a volunteer. And then there's a tab for donors to help us in our fundraising efforts as well.
We appreciate the work you're doing in this community. There are so many that are benefiting from it. I've been speaking with Katie Robinson. She is the program director at CASA. This is The Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host.
Finally, we'll take a look back at the origin of downtown San Luis Obispo's Farmers Market and look ahead to see what we can expect upon its reopening.
Welcome to Around Downtown, our monthly segment on KCBX issues and ideas. I am your host, Bettina Swigger, and in full disclosure, in addition to being your friendly radio host, I am also the CEO of Downtown Slow, our placemaking organization in San Luis Obispo. For today's episode, I'm going to have a conversation with Whitney Cheney, who is the Thursday Night Farmers Market Manager for Downtown Slow, and we're going to talk about how the farmers market has been a force of economic development in downtown, her role, and what things might look like in the future. So welcome, Whitney. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So I thought it might be fun to talk a little bit about your personal upbringing, because I know you have a long history with the market. So can you talk a little bit about your background and what maybe your first experience was at the Thursday night market?
I am a born and raised San Luis Obispo resident. Got out of here a little bit after high school, of course. Everyone had to spread their wings a little bit. But I am very familiar with the market since childhood. It was just a thing you did as a resident. You would bring your family and friends who had never been here to the market. Now that I work at the market, I did find some pictures in our archives of me at the farmer's market as a kid, which was kind of a full circle moment. I've participated in the costume contest at the Halloween events. You know, I've participated in holiday activities, gone to get produce, to eat the ribs, the rib cook-off, all the whole gamut. I'm very familiar with all the things. So it's been really fun to grow up as a visitor and now come full circle and see it from the other side and get to operate this really cool, exciting event.
So the market is not just a giant street fair, but it's really a way to promote and support the small businesses and the businesses that are downtown. And you have a unique family connection to downtown business.
Beyond being born and raised here, I've been very fortunate. Both of my parents have operated businesses downtown for several years. My dad owned a surf shop there. 40 plus years in business and still operating under new ownership, but we are very familiar with being a business downtown.
Definitely. And I know the farmers market has a unique origin story.
Yes, it does. So the market itself was started, like I said, in the interest of the businesses, but there was another layer to that. There was a huge problem with cruise nights happening on Thursdays. So people were cruising in their cars downtown, and literally that's what it is. They just drive through town. And my uncle was one of those people. So he was very familiar with it. When I got this job, he laughed and told me a story about it. But yeah, because of cruising, farmers market was a way to curb the cruisers and open up the streets to pedestrians and just make it a more family-friendly, wholesome event.
Yeah, it's so funny that it was born out of this sort of need to address public safety. And the ultimate irony, I think, is that early on in the first COVID shutdown, when the market closed, what came back?
Cruise night. It was so, gosh, COVID-19 really brought up some weird silver linings on this thing, but there was a resurgence on cruise night. At first I was like, oh my gosh, no, it's everything I've worked so hard to not have, but it was kind of a cool event to see, and it was short lived, but it was fun. And it did bring the community together and in a safe way when there was really not a lot for them to do safely. So in that respect, we were excited for it. And I know that the businesses were excited to see people, and, you know, people could get their takeout and the old cars. I would see grandparents with their kids getting back out there and reminiscing. So that part was cool.
Yeah. And so we're coming up on, it's been a year now with no farmers market.
Crazy.
The farmers market was started in 1983, correct? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So it operated, it was one of the longest running farmers markets in the state of California. And I know your predecessor would go and present to other communities and towns and talk about how to start something like this. What is the process for trying to restart the farmers market? And do you have a plan in place? I probably not any tentative dates yet, but what does that look like? And how has it looked last year?
I mean, ever since we closed down, we continued to think of ways to bring it back in some format. So we started with a virtual farmers market where people could go online and click through to the farms and whatnot and try to support the farmers elsewhere. Currently, where we're at a year later is we're in talks with our partners, you know, with the city and the county, with our farmers, with the vendors that used to participate, and really trying to get a sense of how we can bring our market back to downtown SLO in a safe way, because we used to bring thousands of people together. The whole idea of the market was to walk around, roam, experience it at your leisure. And now, as everyone's probably well aware, when you go to a grocery store, when you go to any sort of space, there are now rules and regulations in place where you have to wait in line. You have to space yourself out. There's an entrance and an exit. Like, these things that never we just took for granted all the time, now we have to really consider with these events. So we're really looking at ways to come back in a safe way, in a much smaller phased approach, as is every event that's coming back. Everything's starting off in a limited capacity and then slowly coming back to full form. That's kind of our mindset. So we're looking at ways to, one, bring back the certified farmers, which is just the produce, veggies, stapled goods like baked goods and whatnot, because that is technically allowed right now. It has been since the shutdown, and we're very fortunate and grateful that the other certified farmers markets, the daytime markets, have operated within San Luis Obispo County to help support our farming community.
And that's true throughout the entire listening area for KCBX, right? So Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, Southern Monterey County, they all have farmers market. So it's not like the farmers haven't been able to sell stuff.
Yeah. And the farmers that are at our market, they kind of do like a circuit. So they go to several markets within the week. So the faces you're used to seeing at Thursday, you'll see at other markets in the county, which is great. But we also know like proximity to the market is important. So a lot of our downtown community members that are used to going to Thursday and getting the fresh produce, the restaurants themselves, they've been really missing that connection. And so we're excited to get the farmers back into Higuera Street first, as soon as we can safely do it.
That's an interesting point about the restaurants. Do they buy wholesale from the farmers? Like the chefs go out? What does that look
like? Yeah, that was always one of the fun. It was kind of like this secret society at the market where if you knew where to look and at what time, you would see the restaurants, even the restaurant owners themselves, they'd haul out their hand trucks, their food dollies, whatever you want to call them, and all the empty boxes. And they would go to their farmers and they'd contact them ahead of time and say, okay, I'm going to need this for my menu. So then the farmer would kind of know what to expect. And then sometimes, you know, they would just come on site and be like, ooh, that's looking really great tonight. I'm going to buy 3 cases of strawberries and make this amazing dessert. But they swoop in the back of the vendor booth, collect all their fresh produce, and then haul it to the restaurant to literally like cook it that night or to prepare it for the weekend. And it's just like, what a cool experience. Like literally farm to table is happening on Higuera Street. And so I think that part's going to be really exciting to see come back to life, because thankfully they've kept in touch with those farmers, but it's another logistic. It's another, you know, loading truck, distance, all that kind of stuff. It's harder for the farmer to get it to them. Maybe the timing's not right. And so Thursday market, it's coming back.
Even if the barbecue vendors and that kind of pull up a curb vibe that we used to have isn't in place, what are you anticipating visitors to the market still enjoying?
The one really cool thing that came out of this is the parklets. And a lot of our restaurants built these outdoor parklets and the bistro lights, the whole vibe is just so lovely. And my ideal vision of what our market's going to look like upon return will be a certified farmer's market with the farmers and baked goods that you can take home and make breakfast the next day. And then once you get all your goods, you're going to wander the streets, find a restaurant. You can do indoor dining right now. That is currently allowed at limited capacity. But since a lot of our restaurants participate in the market, you'll have those name recognition pieces as you walk through downtown, and then you'll get to experience the full menu, which is not always available at farmers. You'll get to experience kind of a different side of the restaurant and get to meet probably the owners and support them in a way till they can come back. So it's going to be a full kind of good partnership, I think.
And there's another sort of get to know your farmer aspect, which is some of the most fun part of coming to the market. Off the top of your head, do you know if there are any farmers who've been selling their produce at the market since it began?
I'm pretty sure, let's say there's 30 farmers. I think I can say in good confidence that at least 20 of them have been here for probably 20 plus years, if not more. Like most of them have been here since day one, I think. And I think that just goes to show, I mean, the farming community is generations and generations. And I've found all these old photos of like Hayashi and the generations of the family. You can watch the photos of, you know, the grandparents and then the grandchildren. And then you find a photo later and you can tell that that's the grandchild that's 5 years older now. And it's just so fun to see that kind of evolution, and just the history with this thing is just so fun to represent. And so, yeah, Hayashi is definitely one of them that's been with us from day one. Batista's probably been there a long time. L&C Smith Groves, Avila and Sons. There's just so many.
Has there been any evolution over your visits to the market from childhood on in the types of produce and fruits and vegetables that are for sale?
Probably. I mean, full disclosure, I was a kid, so I was running through there and like more excited about dinner, but and strawberries. There's always strawberries. I think through my own education now there's been evolution. I think that's part of the part that I maybe took for granted as a kid, like cherry moyas. Do you know what that is? I've never heard of those until I started working at the market, and they're like this hybrid guava pineapple fruit that looks like an artichoke on the outside. It's just this like phenomenal little fruit thing that I just was fully unaware of. And now it has become like this fun thing to talk about and learn about. And I convinced several people to buy them. They're only there for like 2 weeks out of the year. It's just this like hot commodity. But I think that part, and this is one of the silver linings I'm hoping when we come back, we'll be able to educate the consumers a bit more on the produce side. So this first phase will just be certified farmers, which will really highlight them and really give the attention they so deserve that can maybe get a little buried sometimes with all the noise, the good noise, which will also come back, the sounds and the music and all the chatter down the line that will return. But I'm hopeful that we can elevate the knowledge for our local community on exactly what else is there besides strawberries, besides broccoli, besides kale. There's all these fun bacon avocados and other fun things that you can purchase. And I think that part, I wish I would have known more about that as a kid, but hopefully we can educate the kids now.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Contributor Bettina Swigger is speaking with Downtown SLO's Thursday Night Farmers Market Manager, Whitney Cheney.
One of the other things you've done over the course of the shutdown really is connect with other market operators in other downtowns. And I'm curious how our market in San Luis Obispo is similar to other farmers markets in downtown organizations and how it differs. Is there overlap or are we special?
I think there is overlap. We are definitely seen as a benchmark for other downtown businesses that want to operate markets. A lot of people reach out and say, we want to do exactly what you're doing. Can you tell us how? And it's one of those situations where I can tell you how, but I'm not sure it can ever be recreated. The timing of it all, you know, the history of it being 30 plus years, I don't know if you can land and really create that same sort of vibe. The nice thing about the other downtown associations that are operating markets is that overlap of it being for their downtown districts definitely is there. The support of the local community is there. The farmers connecting the produce and allowing better nutrition out into the community, that overlap is definitely all still there. But the 5+ blocks, the 120 plus vendors, the thousands of people coming through, that's a little more unique to our market. We are a unique situation of meeting street fair and farmers market, and it works. And I think that is maybe why we get so many people wanting to mimic what we're doing, because they're either a street fair or they are farmers and they want to find that middle ground.
Well, it's going to be a good climb up to get it back to where it was. It's good to hear some optimism about what could be. And are there any other elements of, you know, the importance of access to fruit and vegetables, especially maybe for some of our marginalized communities? Are there any programs like that that exist at the market?
That's a big component. As we plan our return, we want to make sure we have a lot of the programs in place that we offered beforehand, including things like SNAP or EBT, electronic benefits transfer, which allows someone to get, they can get as much as they want through EBT and use it at the market. And then we have a market match program that we previously offered where for every $15 they spent, they would get a market match of a bonus 15. So essentially free $15 to use. And it's important that we're able to offer that to these marginalized communities, to these low-income families, because the nutritional value on this produce that you find at the farmers market is way higher than what you would find at a grocery store that maybe transported items across state lines that has been harvested months prior, has been literally like apples. Those are actually put to sleep and put dormant for up to a year in like an apple freezer. It's the weirdest thing. But as soon as you pick something, the nutritional value is already decreasing. So it's so, so important to have access to this stuff. And so we're really working to make sure that we do have that EBT in place, that we have the resources for people to sign up for it if they're not familiar with it, because it is a bit of a confusing program. And we want to make sure that people have access to that.
What happens to the fruits and vegetables at the end of the market if they are unsold?
We team up with Glean and they come through. They're kind of like these little secret society again. You never really notice them, but it's all volunteer based. They come through and collect all of the produce and fruits and veggies that were not sold. And then they bring it to Slo Food Bank and it is distributed to those in need, which is super cool. And on average, it'll be like one night there was over 400 pounds of produce, which is just phenomenal. That might've been like a lower end night. Like it's pretty cool. It's pretty great too, that the farmers support it. because they could try to take it somewhere else and sell it. And, you know, they have their circuit of markets and whatnot, but I think there's a little bit of an understanding there and a partnership. And yeah, we're very thankful for Glean and all the work they do. And if you don't know who they are, check them out. You can Google Glean and it'll show up. They have an Instagram, and the work they do is so great.
Yeah. Well, I know the market is near and dear to you, and I just want to wrap this up by asking if there's one thing about the farmer's market in its return that you'd like to share with our listeners and have them keep in mind.
Yeah, I think that the one thing you can keep in mind as we do plan our return and when we do return is that the market will return not as it left. It will not be a vendor line, five blocks of hot food, everything, entertainment. But it will be at the heart still our farmer's market, and it will get back to that full scale. So trust in that and enjoy the condensed new version of it now. Enjoy the farmers, enjoy being back downtown, supporting the community. Wear your mask, follow the guidelines. I just look forward to what will be and enjoy the now.
And never take it for granted again.
And never take it for granted again. That is definitely true. We are so excited to get back, and we look forward to it as soon as we can.
Well, thank you so much, Whitney. And if the listeners out there want to learn about the farmers market return, how will they stay up to date?
Yeah, you can follow us on Instagram, Downtown Slow Farmers Market. You can go to our website, downtownslow.com, and under events, you will find farmers market and all of the information. We also have a Facebook, Downtown Slow Farmers Market, or stop by the office and check in. We're located at 1135 Choro Street.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Whitney Cheney, the Farmers Market Manager for Downtown San Luis Obispo. And this is Bettina Swigger for KCBX Issues and Ideas with our monthly program called Around Downtown.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Francisco Martinez. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head on over to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.